Bonjour à toutes et tous, vous écoutez First Print, votre podcast comics préféré pour une nouvelle émission du format Super Friends. À l'occasion du FIBD, vous l'aurez compris, on a posé nos micros pour faire une tonne d'interviews avec plein de personnalités du monde des comics. Et on vous proposera même un programme un petit peu spécial avec notre invité du jour, Mattson Tumlin. Puisque le co-scénariste de The Batman, l'auteur de Batman Imposter, mais aussi de Vicious Circle, est de passage dans notre pays. Et on s'est dit qu'on allait mettre les bouchées doubles avec une première émission où en fait on va vraiment discuter de sa carrière d'auteur, sa façon d'aborder l'écriture. Et on vous proposera un autre épisode spécial avec Liber Mero pour parler ensemble de Vicious Circle. Donc là, c'est le podcast en duo, en solo même. Le générique va se lancer juste après. Ce sera donc en anglais pour les anglophones. On espère que vous apprécierez tout cela. Et je suis content de retrouver Mattson juste après. So this is really great to have you here, Mattson Tumlin, in our podcast. Thank you for giving us a little bit of your time.
Thank you for having me. I'm so sorry I don't speak French.
Well, yeah, you can't have all the qualities in the world, so it's all right if you're just your only default is just to not speak French. It's quite all right. So basically, I'm always starting with the most basic question in the world, like who are you? Can you just introduce yourself a little bit for those who are listening to us?
Sure. Who are you is not a basic question. That's the hardest question. Who am I? I am a screenwriter. I live in Los Angeles. I mostly write movies. I wrote a movie that's a Netflix film with Jamie Foxx called Project Power that came out in 2020. I wrote a movie called Little Fish that stars Olivia Cooke and Jack O'Connell. I wrote and directed a movie called Mother Android starring Chloe Grace Moretz. And I have been working with Matt Reeves on The Batman Part 2 most recently. And I grew up on the East Coast of the United States and wanted to make movies since I was a little kid and went to several film schools, worked really hard, and all my dreams came true. And so I am just having the time of my life working on really cool shit.
Like really, like do you know when you were younger why you wanted so hard to be in the film in the filmmaking?
Yeah, you know, it came in waves, but you know, by the time that I was 7-8 years old, I knew that I wanted to make movies. And then around 10, 11, 12, it was really by the time that I was 12, I had a film called Stand By Me, and I had what I like to call it my Stand By Me summer, where it was the summer where all of my friends were starting to grow up, and suddenly they were getting interested in girls and sports, and it was no longer all of us getting dressed up in costumes and playing in the woods and pretending that we were knights or pretending that we were superheroes. And that was really sad for me because I didn't want to grow up. I wanted to just keep playing. And what I realized is that if there was a camera around, that then it became a project. And then everybody that was so anxious to grow up, it's like they'd put the costumes and the face paint back on and they'd keep on playing. And so for me, it wasn't so much that I saw a movie and said, oh, now I want to make movies. It was much more that I wanted to keep on playing.
And so you did at a very young age to decide that you were going to do the studies in order to be a filmmaker.
Yeah.
Is it hard? Is it easy to go into that kind of schools?
To get into the schools are it's not that difficult. You know, you put together a portfolio. So typically they want to see that you've made some films. And when you're going into college, usually it's, you know, the movies that you've made with your friends. I went to graduate school. I went to the American Film Institute, and that was a lot more competitive to get into. But no, going to film school, it's just like any other school. It's like you have to have a body of work and then they let you in. I think that the thing that's a lot harder is becoming a working professional in Hollywood. And the reason that that's harder is because unlike a doctor or a lawyer, where there's a set path, and you go to school for a certain number of years, and then you get a job, and then you work your way up, and it's very straightforward. Nobody in Hollywood has the same story about how they broke in and how they got their career. Everybody's story is completely different. And really the only commonality is that they worked really, really hard and they were very, very lucky. And so it's kind of a shit show.
So what's your story?
My story is after graduating from the American Film Institute, I graduated in 2014 and I went for directing and I wanted to be a director. And what I learned very quickly is that when you want to be a director, nobody in the world wants you to be a director because directing involves a lot of money. You know, to make a movie is expensive. It's millions of dollars. And it just involves other people's permission. And I tried to get a movie made. I wanted to get a little indie done that I could then take to Sundance. And that was kind of the dream. And that didn't work out. Tried to get some other projects off the ground. That didn't work out. And a professor of mine at the AFI, he had a really great piece of advice. He would always say, if you want a job in Hollywood, you have to write your way to the table. Because writing is the one thing that is free. Doesn't involve anybody's permission. Doesn't involve anything else. You can sit down. Anybody can sit down at any point in time and write a movie. Whether or not they can write it well or not, that's a whole other thing. Mm. But there's nothing stopping anybody from sitting down and writing. And so I made a pivot and started writing. And at first my writing was quite poor, but...
How would you define poor in terms of quality or...
The writing was not mature. I didn't quite understand what a movie was. I didn't quite understand what made a good scene. Just the actual technical mechanics of the things that should be invisible. But if you don't have them... then the movie doesn't work. And the one thing I had going for me was that I really enjoyed the process of writing. You know, a lot of writers that I know now, they describe writing and they just say, writing is hell. It's just agony. I hate sitting down and writing. There's a saying for writers of, you know, I don't love writing. I love having already written. And for me, I love writing. Like I really love being in it and dreaming. So I had that going for me. And so I just started to write a lot. And I started writing 8 to 10 scripts a year, which is sizable. And not all of those scripts were good. Most of them were bad. But you keep doing it over and over and over. And you finish something and you look at it and you go, what's good about this? What's bad about this? Can this be better? And I started to really learn and I started to really train. And it's kind of like running. It's like if you've never run before and you try to run a mile, it's going to be really hard for you. But if you keep every day going back at it, pretty soon a mile is going to be very easy. And then you can start working on 5 miles, 10 miles. And it was similar to that where I just started to build up so that the point that even now, like I'll write a bad script sometimes, but my batting average has gotten quite a bit better. And at a certain point around 2015, 2016, my writing started to get attention. And then
because you were submitting the scripts to
submitting to some contests. And then I lived in Hollywood and one of the things that became really clear to me is that, you know, people are so anxious to get the script in front of the big important person who's going to make all their dreams come true. And I realized pretty quickly, that's not really how things work. I don't need the big important person. And I don't need the person that works for the big important person. I need the assistants. I need the people who are my age, who are working the desks, working the phones, and who are also trying to climb the same way that I'm trying to climb. So I knew a lot of assistants. And so I started sending scripts to friends of mine who worked in Hollywood as assistants, and they started going, the script is good, you're getting to be a better writer. And then they're also trying to come up, and so they start sharing the scripts around because they want to seem smart. And so that was a big part of how I broke in, just getting attention because I met other young people who are trying to make it in Hollywood. And it's like you all lift each other up. Like that's how it should work in a healthy industry. And so then there were a couple of years, 2-3 years of getting paid some money, Not a lot, but enough to live and enough to feel like, oh, like there's momentum here. I can feel like this could happen and this could start to be a lifestyle, but hard to, you know, get, you know, some thousands of dollars and then having to stretch that over months and, you know, really living paycheck to paycheck. And then I started to make some bigger sales, and I sold a television show that of course didn't get made, but it paid me a lot. And then a year after that, I sold the original spec script to Power, which became Project Power. And that was enough money that it really changed my life, and it got me out of student debt. And that movie, that whole process was so fast. Going from writing it to selling it was about 8 months, which is unheard of. And then from selling it to making it was less than a year, also unheard of. So it went from an idea in my head to a finished movie in just a little bit over 2 years, which for a movie of that size never ever happens. That was kind of the start of being a real professional.
Yeah, it seems to be the turning point,
yeah,
of your career. But when you're writing and the script is being bought by some a big entity like Netflix, does they give you commands to rewrite scenes or stuff like that, or did they just buy it and then you were done, you had nothing less?
In that case there were considerable rewrites. The movie that got made is very different from the movie that I sold, and
isn't it that frustrating to
yes
you? For you? Okay.
Yes. It's frustrating, it's hard. Sometimes it's for good, sometimes it's for bad. You know, they're in the case of Project Power, the movie means a lot to me. It's the first movie that I got made. It's very different from what I originally was trying to do, but in part that's because the directors, Henry Joost and Ariel Schulman, who made that movie, they had a different vision for it. And they are guys who are very almost kind of whimsical, and they really like to make movies for an audience they want people to enjoy their movies. And my script was much, much darker, and so part of the process was just, we have to make this movie more fun. And so does that mean that it's bad? No, it's just different. And so
you can't say it's bad on the record. I assume
it's just different. Yeah, it's just different.
I wouldn't want you to say things that you cannot say. But so when you're writing, writing scripts in terms of techniques, are you starting with a plot or with characters? What's the most important things to you to set right first?
Yeah, man, the truth is it's different every time. It's really, you know, I wish that I could say, here's my process and this is how, you know, you go from idea to movie. And, you know, if I could just follow that process every single time, it would be way easier. But the truth of the matter is that ideas are mercurial. And this professor from AFI who said, write your way to the table, he had another phrase that really stuck with me, where he said that art and filmmaking and writing, he would say, it is sculpting in fucking vapor. It's really delicate. It's really fragile. And art and emotion and channeling something that you feel into something that people can hold in their hands or watch on a screen and have it translate through the artistic process of getting it made, it's fragile. It can break really easily. You have to take care of it. And because of that, I've found that there isn't a set path ever. Sometimes, so to now finally answer the question after that long ramble, sometimes I will have a character and there will be an emotion that this character is feeling, and I won't know what's going on with them, but the character will just be so strong in my head that I've really, you know, it's almost like sitting down with this character in your head and then just listening to them, and you just kind of follow them and they tell you what's going on with them. There are other times where I've started with a premise, and, you know, Project Power started with the premise. It started with the idea of there's a little pill that is an illegal street drug. And when you take it for 5 minutes, you get high. and your high is that you get a superpower. And the deal is that you don't know what power you're going to get. And everybody gets a different power. And there's a 75% chance that your power will kill you. And going from that, it was just kind of like, okay, how would that change the world? And who are the characters that could be in this? And so it was kind of premise first. The idea came first. And then the characters filled in. So every time it's a little bit different, which on the one hand, that makes it exciting because, you know, I'm always having to grow and learn and figure out new tricks to get it on the page. And on the other hand, it's terrifying because each and every single time I feel like, oh my God, I have no idea what I'm doing and I've got to figure it all out again like I've never done it.
Mm-hmm. Has it happened a lot that some you submit scripts that are bought without even having a show or a movie in the end? It really seems to me like the industry is spending a lot of money on just scripts that just don't get made.
Hollywood is not the place to look to for a model of efficiency. And I mean, that's the thing. It's that making movies is hard. Like it's really, really hard. It's part of the reason that I love comics, which I'm sure we'll get to later. But
yeah,
you know, to make a movie at minimum involves 200 people, and it involves a tremendous amount of money, and it involves everybody getting onto something that seems like the same page. Usually, you can't get 200 people on the same page. So then the hope is you can get them on the same book, and you know, we're also in this time where people are going to the movie theaters a lot less, and streaming has really changed viewing habits. And, you know, like we had a good year this year. We had a good year with you know, things like Oppenheimer and Barbie, but also there are so many movies. You know, are people still showing up for superhero movies? Like, you could say yes, you could say no. Yeah, exactly.
It really depends.
Mm-hmm. Are people showing up for original films? It really depends. It seems like if you make a horror movie, people will go to that. But, you know, where are the romantic comedies? I was watching this movie from 2002 that stars Julia Roberts called Mona Lisa Smile. I'd never seen this movie before, but I was watching it recently. And it's great. Like it's just a really solid drama from 2002. And I'm watching this movie thinking, this would not get made today. Like there's no movie that's similar to Mona Lisa Smile that's coming out in theaters right now. And if this were to get made today, it would be a 10-hour miniseries on Netflix. That's what it would have to be. And it doesn't need to be 10 hours. I'm very happy watching this 2-hour thing. So anyway, it's a long way of saying just that we're in kind of a tricky time, but also there is the hard thing about movie making, the hard thing about Hollywood is that it is this clash of art and commerce. And so the people who are paying for the movies, they just want to know that they're going to not just make their money back, but get more and more and more money. And then for the artists, they're trying to be artists and the money is less important. So you have these two sides that are always clashing and you're not always going to agree. And that's why a lot of the times, like, you can sell something and it's not going to get made because not everybody goes, oh yeah, this can be art and it can also make its money back.
And do you have like something to learn also with the frustration we mentioned just before, like either that it's a script that's not being made into something or it's a script that's being turned into something else? Is it like something you like learn the hard way to just also be okay with that? That today, if you're going to submit a script, you won't care maybe as much as you did before when it's done in another way?
It's tricky. I mean, you have to care. You have to care because it's art. And so I think that for me to be, you know, successful in what I do, it's like I really have to put my heart into it. And so when you put your heart into something, you care about it. And if you stop caring about it, then it's just trash. It's just content. And I'm not trying to make content.
That's the horrible way.
Yeah, that's
a really
dirty little
horrible word. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's not what I'm trying to do. But I also, what I've found is that the likelihood is that something is not going to get made. It's so, I know writers who are 20 years older than I am, who have been working basically the entire time that I've been alive, and they've been making money and, you know, putting their kids through school and live, you know, living a full life, and have never gotten a movie made. There are so many working screenwriters who sell, but then, like, that getting over that threshold to get the movie made, like, it's hard. And so I think that for me, there was a lesson that I learned early on of, I can't put all of my eggs in one basket. I can't put all of my hopes on one project or two projects. So that thing that I said earlier of I write 10 scripts a year, I'm still kind of like that, where I can put my heart into a lot of different things. And then if something doesn't go, I'll be hurt. I'll be upset. I'll wish that it was getting made. But I've got 9 other things to think about that I'm also trying to get made. And so that has meant that my batting average is a lot higher, because it's like going to Las Vegas and you would never go to Las Vegas with your life savings and then bet your life savings on one bet. And there are a lot of people who go to Hollywood and do that. They have their one script or their one idea, and they think that one idea is the thing. And if that one idea doesn't work, they're ruined. And guess what? It doesn't work, and then they're ruined. And for me, I realize, no, you have to make a lot of bets.
Okay. Switching a little bit to the comics, but we mentioned the Project Pod just before that has superpowers in it. So it's kind of a real big part of the American culture, but more specifically also superheroes comic books. Are you a fan of comic books? Of superheroes comic books?
Definitely.
And did you have reading that inspired you for Project Power? Because the drug is like, it's like the Miraclo, or we have some kind of drug that gives you superpowers in comic books also.
Yeah. I think that for me, there was just the idea. And then it was also, you know, I wrote Project Power at a point when I wasn't working on something like Batman, and I was still just trying to have a career. And I love superpowers. I love superheroes. I love comic books. I learned to read off of comic books. Like, comics are my first love. They come before film. And I think that for me, there was a part of it that was like, oh, you know, well, I wish that Marvel would call me. I wish that DC would call me. And so how could I get their attention? What could I do? And so for me, it seemed dangerous to try to write a superhero story, an original superhero story. Those don't really get made. And when they do, they often don't really work, because audiences, they like their iconography. They like, you know, they want to see Spider-Man. They want to see Batman. And so if you're making something up out of nothing, it kind of makes you go, what is that? Why am I seeing that? So I knew I couldn't make a superhero film, but I could make a superpower film. And really the influences for Project Power for me were Collateral and Training Day, and thinking, you know, how cool would it be if you took kind of the models of those movies and dropped superpowers in the middle of them? Like, it's kind of ridiculous to say, but it was also, that was kind of the idea that got me going. But it did come from a love of a certain kind of thriller, and then going, okay, but now what if you added a kind of comic bookiness into it? Because that was, felt like something that we weren't seeing at the time. So it felt kind of fresh and new to do.
What are your favorite comic books? What would you say?
You know, my North Star that I'm kind of always revisiting it is the like early 2000s run that Brian Michael Bendis and Alex Maleev did of Daredevil. Like, I read that. I honestly go back to it maybe once a year, because there's something about that run that felt, you know, I was reading it as a kid at the time, but still,
you were too young for that.
It felt so
adult.
Isn't
it like M for Mature for on the cover?
I don't think it is, because I mean it's not overly sexual. It's not overly violent. It, you know, all of the bad words are blurred out.
Mm-hmm.
But it's adult, like, it, you know, in a time when Ultimate Spider-Man and Ultimate X-Men were being launched at the same time. By the way, Brian Michael Bendis doing all of that at once, kind of incredible. But the Daredevil book, it was just so much more adult emotionally, and it was the thing that reading it, it really made me go, I didn't know that comics could do this. You know, it's kind of the same thing as when you watch like a sitcom as a kid and then you discover HBO and then you go, I didn't know television could do this. I didn't know this was allowed. So that's
yeah, from Modern Family to Oz.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And so that one is just huge, huge, huge for me because it's Daredevil and it has the costumes, it has the jumping off of buildings, it has all of that great stuff, but ultimately it is so in lockstep with Matt Murdock's pain and, you know, his relationships, his girlfriends, his heartbreak. And I just kind of like when that becomes more compelling than Daredevil's going to fight somebody, like that to me really made me go, oh, whoa, I want to do that. I'm feeling feelings right now. And I want to make people feel those kinds of feelings too. So I'm constantly going back to that run.
Okay. You mentioned also the Batman just before, like you're working on the Batman too. But I think that DC, when they were promoting Batman Imposter, promoted you, was saying that you were also a co-writer of the first Batman movie. Can you tell us a little bit about how you got into that project?
Sure. So I wrote and eventually directed a movie called Mother Android. Mm-hmm. And when I was getting that movie set up, I knew that I needed a producer and I wanted the producer to be a filmmaker. I wanted the producer to be a director, somebody that had directed movies that I really respected and who could be kind of a mentor to me. And the list of people who I wanted to work with is short, and Matt Reeves was at the very top of the list. And I got the script to Matt's company and his executives at his company, Six in Idaho. They read it. And then that's how I first met Matt Reeves, is actually him saying that he loved my script and that he wanted to give me notes and that he would produce my film. So I was already in Matt's sphere as he and I were working on my film. And then he had been working on the Batman for some time, for a year and a half or so. And he had been working, and then he had been working with his co-writer, Peter Craig. And then he got to a point where he was almost finished and needed some help with the third act. And so I came into the process very late, and he and I spent about 6 months working together and building a third act for the movie. And so I was there for the finish of that film. And because of how credit works in Hollywood, I ended up not getting credit on the yeah. movie. And that's kind of its own separate thing, which at the time was painful, but only just because, hey, like I worked on this thing. Like, I wish I could see my name up there. But ultimately, the people who needed to know knew what I had done and what I had contributed to that movie. And Matt and I had a really, really wonderful experience working together, which then caused him to ask me to come back for the second one. And now here we are.
And on that one, you would be credited.
Let's hope. Yeah.
Yeah. But even though that your name was out in the trades, like Hollywood Reporter or yeah. Variety, because we knew that that you were doing that. But could you explain to us who are not in the filmmaking industry why it would take so long to rewrite a third act of a movie? I understand that it's a blockbuster movie, it's a Batman movie, there's Warner and stuff, yeah. but really, like 6 months seems to be huge for yeah. the a third of the script.
Sure. Because Matt Reeves is striving for greatness, and it's really hard to make a great movie. And, you know, you look at that, the first Batman, and it's a detective story. And it's a detective story that really works. And so a detective story, it's one of the more complex kind of narratives that you can do. You know, it is like calibrating a watch. And so all of the pieces have to fit together. And because it's Batman, Batman can't look stupid. And so he's the world's greatest detective. And so along the way, you're getting a clue. Batman is getting a clue, and the audience is getting a clue. And at every moment that he's getting a clue, there has to be a theory of what's going on. And that theory has to make sense in that moment. And the audience has to go, yeah, that makes sense. That's probably what's happening. And Batman has to do that as well. And every time you get a new clue, the theory changes. And all of the theories along the way, they have to match up with what's actually happening. And so it's a story on top of a story on top of a story on top of a story. So it's just complex. And then, you know, it just sometimes writing takes a lot of time. You know, sometimes, it, you know, there are scripts that you work on that, you know, there, I have written scripts over the course of a week or two. And then there are other scripts that I've worked on for years. So it's also kind of, you know, what the movie demands of you. And in the case of Batman, you know, it demands a level of greatness. It's like people really care about Batman. You like being one of the people involved in it now, it's like you want it to be the best one. And so that bar is just so high. So you take your time and you try to do something great. You know, you try to just bring a lot of care to it.
And I guess also that maybe you have also just meetings with producers or stuff, and that might sometimes you'd have to rewrite scenes because the production would need to do scenes in another way. Or in this case, was it really just the two of you? And
yeah, it's kind of a
I don't want to sure, make you breach an NDA, of course.
It's just a mixture of all of that stuff. I mean, you're always battling a budget. Right. You could make a movie for $500 million and it still wouldn't be enough money. You always need more money and you always need to make it for less. And so you're always battling that. But no, I mean, in the case of that first Batman movie, it was really just a matter of, we've just got to finish it and make it feel great and make it feel right. And finding that ending, it's not that it was elusive, but it was complex. And I think that movie is complex in levels that are sometimes hard for people to see. You know, one of the hardest scenes that I've ever been involved in writing in that first movie is the scene where Batman and Gordon get into the Riddler's apartment after he's been arrested. And we're finally getting a glimpse into, you know, they're going through the ledgers and they're reading, and there's just so much detail of, they walk in and we're reading ledgers and we're looking at all of the contraptions and the bombs. And then, oh, there's another note and we think it's a rat. That's not a rat, man. And there's a bat in there. Like, there's just so many things. It's a long scene. It's a 7-8 page scene. And most scenes are 2 pages. So there's a density to it. And then, you know, having Batman go in there, and then you're seeing this wall of newspaper clippings and pictures, and Batman looking there thinking, oh no, he's found out who I am. Like, this is all and all of this has to be conveyed visually, but internally, Batman isn't turning to Gordon and saying, he's figured out who I am. And so
that would be very bad writing.
Yeah. There's bad writing and there's good writing. And then there's great writing. And in this case, it's so dense. But when you're watching the movie, nobody should be thinking, wow, this is so dense. And how'd they get all this detail? And they're just watching the movie and getting the details and just hopefully loving it. Because that's the magic of movies, is that it should seem effortless, even though it's one of the hardest scenes that I've ever been a part of, and it still gives me nightmares when I think about it.
So I guess also that, like, you could have too much exposition or too much information just the dialogue, that would be like lazy writing to you.
And Batman's, you know, he's a tricky character to write. He's demanding because
he doesn't speak much.
He can't. Yeah. If Batman starts talking too much, you're in trouble. Mm. You don't want him monologuing. You got to be very careful about what he says and how he says it. And then there are also just, you know, funny realities to Batman where, you know, you've got to be careful. You know, when Matt has described being on set and just, you know, having to light that suit in the right way, just to make sure that it always looks cool, because it's ridiculous. Like, it is a ridiculous thing. And if you put him under fluorescent lighting, like what we're sitting under right now, it's going to look weird. And so there's a version of that in the scenes too, where you're always having to go, okay, Batman can't say this, and he can't, you know, it's like Batman can't sit in a chair. It would be weird for Batman to sit down in a chair. And that's very specific. Like when you're writing a normal movie, it's like, yeah, you can have a guy sit in a chair. Yeah. It's going to be okay.
The poor life of Batman that cannot sit on a chair. But can you tell us a little bit how you came from the Batman to the Batman imposter? I don't know if you were already contacted by DC before getting onto Matt Reeves' project, or was it more?
No. I begged them. I just begged them. You know, as I said, I came on to the first Batman late. And that was a total joy and experience I wouldn't trade for the world. And I had so many ideas that just could not apply. That just, you know, the movie, like I said, like I only worked on the third act. So my contribution was more minimal. And that doesn't mean I wasn't excited and doesn't mean that I wasn't dreaming. So I just found that I had this flood of ideas and nowhere to put them. And so we finished the movie and Matt goes off to make the movie, and I'm just kind of left there going like, I'm still thinking of Batman. And so I call up one of the film executives at DC. I call up Chantal Nong, and I asked her if I could just meet with somebody at DC Comics, because I always loved comics, always wanted to do a comic, and I just had all these Batman ideas and nowhere to put them. And I was really expecting either no, or I was expecting here's an intern at DC who would be happy to talk to you, and which would have been a dream come true. And instead she goes, oh yeah, sure. Like I'll set you up with Jim Lee. And so
casually.
Yeah.
That's Jim. Hi, Jim.
What's going on? And so, I got to meet Jim for the first time, and we had a lovely meeting, and I told him about working on the movie, and then I told him what I wanted to do. And I said, look, I don't want to do a tie-in. You know, it's not related to the movie other than there's a tone.
There's a tone that really feels like it could be a spin-off of the Batman, right?
Because my favorite kind of Batman, and you know, I know that this is controversial for some people, but my favorite kind of Batman is the one that feels real. It's like, you know, it's part of the reason that I really love Batman Begins, is because, you know, that first 50 minutes of Batman Begins, man, like, you know, when he leaves that bar after getting kicked out, and he's on the pier looking out and throws the gun into the water, and then he gets on a boat to China. You just have this moment where you're like, oh, this feels real. This feels like this could happen. And that's a very, very exciting place. And so when I was brought into the first Batman movie and saw what Matt was doing and going, oh, he's taking this to another level of what if this was real. And people have done that in comics a lot with Batman. It's not a new thing. But I just felt like, oh, you know, narratively, there's some things that I think that I could do that would really make it feel different and challenging. And the two big things were, I want to take away Gordon and I want to take away Alfred, because narratively speaking, when Batman gets into a jam, those are the two guys that typically save him and get him out of hot water. And I just kind of thought, if you take those guys away, bad for him, dangerous for him. And so then what's that? Like, he's just going to be an angry, scary guy who's out there on his own. And just the vibe of that, you know, I the truth of it is a big part of the influence of Imposter was that Matt and I were working late one night, and I leave his office, and so I'm walking on the street outside of his office in Los Angeles.
And you were brooding in the streets.
Yeah. And I'm looking around, and I'm just kind of looking at the buildings and thinking, okay, if there was a crime happening right now, what would Batman do? And I really thought about the reality of it. I'm looking up at these buildings and I'm going, there's no grappling hook. You can't get up there. That's not real. So I'm looking around and I'm realizing, no, it would be like carjackings. Like it would feel like, if we made this real, it would feel like Grand Theft Auto. Like it would feel dangerous. And so that's, you know, that first sequence in Batman the Imposter with the liquor store robbery, and then, you know, guys jacking a car and Batman following them on the bike, and then a big car crash and getting stabbed in the leg. It just, there was a level of brutalism that I just kind of thought, okay, you know, we've seen versions of that before, but I just feel like I've got my finger on the pulse of something that's like pretty edgy and hardcore and exciting to me.
What do you like so much about comic books as a medium?
A lot of different answers to this. I think that the first one that
you
I
can
wanted,
go on.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. I think that the first one for me is that being a filmmaker, like I said before, like making a movie, at minimum 200 people are involved. When you're making a comic book, it's like five. Like it's just fewer people. And comic books are way cheaper to make than movies. And so because of that, that lowers the stakes in a way that you can be a lot more daring and you can take risks and you have less people fucking with what you're trying to do. And so when I look at my comic book work as a writer, I feel like, oh, this is my voice. And this is, like, there's far fewer filters. It didn't have to pass through 200 people to get out. It had to pass through four other people. And it's much easier to get four people on the same page than 200 on the same page. So there's a part of it that is just, it feels much less filtered, you know, in a way that's pretty wonderful. And then, you know, comics were my first love. I learned how to read off of comic books. And I just find that combination of reading plus images, it does something to your brain where it's like you're watching a movie. It comes alive. It's like anybody who reads comic books, they know this feeling of like, it's not quite reading and it's not watching a movie, but it's something else where it dances in your imagination in this kind of wonderful way. And I just also love how comic books can be so many things. And, you know, I'm talking a lot about superhero comic books right now, but there's so many kinds of books out there that, I don't know. It just feels like a medium that is constantly reinventing itself in really, really exciting ways. So, I mean, there's a lot to love about comic books. What's not to love?
I totally agree with you. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here.
Yeah.
Obviously. There was also like a very strong idea in the Batman Impostor that Batman is opposed to another version of himself, but with one very striking difference that he kills.
Yeah.
He kills. And it's also a very like provocative take on the character that Batman who kills, and we've seen other versions of Batman killing in the comics. What makes it so interesting for you to have this kind of distinct line of conduct?
I think that part of it is that there was an opportunity to get kind of meta with it and to comment on the character. And you know, there are people who really like a super violent Batman who is murking people, and it almost feels a little like, oh, you what you really like is the Punisher. And I don't know, like, it's not Batman to me. And so it felt like an opportunity to go, okay, like, they're going to be two Batmen and they're going to be at war with each other, and that's the story, but it's also kind of the story of Batman in our culture right now. And so there's something that was kind of fun about that as well. And then another meta quality to it of, I'd get on Twitter sometimes and
you shouldn't be doing that.
yeah. It's a mistake. I'm trying to get off. But you know, people always posting these memes of like, Bruce Wayne would rather get into a bat suit and beat up homeless people rather than go to therapy. And I just thought there's something kind of funny there. Like, let's send Bruce Wayne to therapy. Like, okay, like let's take these things that are kind of in the culture and just take them all the way. And so having, does Batman kill? Does Batman not kill? And one of the threads through Batman the Imposter is that there's ambiguity for the citizens of Gotham at the end of that story where they're like, what was the imposter and what was Batman? So no one knows. No one is going to be agreeing on that. You know, if I get to do a sequel to Batman the Imposter, that's going to be one of the things that I would play with, is just that, like,
people are not trusting anymore.
Yeah, we're not on the same page about this. And, you know, that's the case in the story. And it's also the case in the world around the characters. Like, we're just not on the same page about, like, and by the way, I think that's great because it's a character that's 80 plus years old and is open to so many different interpretations. And so, but you see people really at war because they care a lot about the character. So then it's like, okay, what makes Batman Batman and what breaks it for you?
And that's maybe also because of this will to be in the more real world that you made also a Batman that like has a really underground tunnels and steals bikes to go from another point to another. It really seems like he's crazy already to do so many things in his city just to be able to go from one point to another one. So also, like you mentioned, that you didn't want to have Gordon or Alfred, but why did you choose Leslie Thompkins as a like another character on which he can rely a little bit?
Yeah, it felt to me like there needed to be a character that could call him out on his shit, and Gordon doesn't really do that. Alfred does, but in like a kind of loving. Coaching way, and she could just be, because it's kind of a different take on her than what people are used to, and it just kind of felt like, oh, like he needs to meet his match, he needs to meet somebody who kind of gets him in line for a little while. And I don't know, you know, I've always really liked the character and have always been like, why don't we see more of her? It's like it seems like she's kind of in and out, and so just again, it felt like an opportunity to do something fresh and a little bit new while still taking things that people would know and recognize but weren't so beholden to, that like I could do a reinvention with Leslie and make her into something a little bit different and not have people screaming at me about it. And so that, you know, that was just, it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun to take the meme of Bruce Wayne should go to therapy and then go, okay, let's see what that looks like. And writing those scenes was a lot of fun.
Am I right if I'm seeing a social commentary in Batman Imposter? Because I think you're discussing really about the impact Batman can have on the economics of the city or even the social politics. What's your point of view on this character? Should we have a real Batman? In real life?
Definitely not. That just seems like whoever that is would get themselves killed really fast. I mean, that's the thing. It's that I think that once you get to a point, it towing that line of you want it to feel real, but it's not real, because if it were real, Batman would get killed on night one, or he'd be arrested, or get a lot of people hurt or killed. And so it's, you know, it kind of, that's why I go back to Bendis and Alex Maleev and Daredevil, where I think that for me, there's realism and there's going, okay, what would this be like if it were real? But the thing that I'm most interested in is it being emotionally real.
I'm just losing my the question that I had. No, about the police brutality. I also it seemed to me that you had also something to say with the police, because in the end we learn that the fake Batman is from the police, and we are discussing throughout the book about police brutality.
Yeah,
and it's certainly echoes what has been going around in the United States, but also in France.
Yeah,
and did you want to make a stance about on that topic?
Yeah, you know, I. Gotham's a really corrupt place. It's a bad place. It's why Batman exists. And I think that, you know, it's one of those things where it's like, I know, like I'm sure lots of people know, you know cops, and like there are people I know who are cops that I'm like, oh boy, you should not be a cop. And then there are other cops that I know that I'm like, that's a good person. And it's tricky because like we're in this time in the world where it's like, okay, like we're dealing with a lot of fascism, we're dealing with a lot of authoritarianism, and you know, like what good is the police right now? Is that a force for good? And depending on where you are in the world, where you are in a country, like the answer is maybe yes, maybe no. And so I don't know, for me it was kind of like, okay, there has to be two sides to that, And so on the one hand, you have the identity of the imposter, this guy Hatcher, who, you know, what he is doing. It's like he blames Batman for the city getting worse. And so he's cleaning up Batman's mess. So he's totally justified. And, you know, he is thinking like this is a law and order thing to do. And then meanwhile, you have Blair Wong, who, like, she's a detective and she's skilled and she, you know, she's just on her path and just trying to do the right thing. And I rather than paint it in a way of like, oh, like cops are good or cops are bad, I think that it's like you just kind of get into the reality of it, which is it's just a fucking mess out there. And it's like to try to paint things in black and white, it gets you in trouble quick.
Even Batman asked her the question, like, would you think it would be better if I wasn't there? And in that case, I would stop. But she doesn't reply to that. And because does she know that? I mean, is she sure that Batman is a bad thing in this world or not?
Yeah. Time will tell. We'll see. I hope I get to write some more Blair Wong.
Okay. in terms of structure, you did a three issues story.
Yeah.
I don't know if that was maybe because of your skills in the screenwriting that you did want to make a three act movie in terms of
comics. Very good. Yeah. Yeah, exactly right. It was my first comic book. Mm. And so it's learning how to write a comic book while also it's like, okay, it's going to be Batman. And people are going to read it and really care about it. And I'm going to make some big choices about Batman. And so for me, it felt important to not try to reinvent the wheel as far as structure. And so very simple, beginning, middle, end. And I said, I just need three and I'll figure out how to tell what I'm trying to tell. But act one, act two, act three, exactly right.
Okay, and last thing also, how about the choice of the artist? Because you were paired with Andrea Sorrentino.
Yeah.
Was it like the editor's choice, you were checking on artist availability?
Yeah, you know, I first sat down with Jim Lee, and then...
I really like how you can just flex it. Like, Jim.
Can you
fetch me an artist, please, Jim?
Going into that meeting with him, I was so nervous. Like, I've spent time with celebrities, like all the Hollywood stuff, and it's like you get to a point where you're kind of over it. I was sweating. Going to sit down with like it was one of those things where it's like I'm really nervous that like this is one of my heroes, like I have loved this man since I was 5 years old, like this is intimidating. So no, it's not at all as like, oh yeah, like sat down with Jit, like it's like I'm still kind of like, how is that real, how did that happen?
Just put in your leg.
But no, after that initial meeting, then I started working with an editor named Mark Doyle, who no longer is at DC, but
great editor.
Yeah. Mark is great, and he was a big part of getting that book together. And I described to Mark, I just keep going back to it, how much I loved Bendis and Alex Maleev and their Daredevil. And I said, you know, I want it to kind of feel like that, like that's my North Star, that's what I'm going to. And so there's a kind of grittiness to Alex's art, and I spent a lot of time talking about faces and eyes and being in shadow and it feeling like a noir. And Doyle was instantly like, oh, Andrea Sorrentino, like let's go get him. And
so you weren't necessarily aware of his work before?
No, I was aware of Andrea, and just but it was Mark's idea. And the second that he said it, I was like, that's an amazing, like, it's again, it's my first comic book, so I don't know how any of this works. Yeah. I don't know who we can or cannot get. Who's gonna give a shit about this? I was so lucky to get to work with Andrea, because he, I say this all the time, but he is a wizard, and just, you know, he makes me look so good in that book because
that's also what I want to question that I had. Like, I've been following Andrea's work for quite some time, that you're not writing every panels and when he's trying to make like this double splash with symbols everywhere, not writing them directly on the script.
What's great about Andrea is that there will be pages where I'll describe every panel And sometimes Andrea will do it just as I've written, and it will be great. And then there will be times where I will describe every panel, and then Andrea will do some of it and then change some things. And the changes will be so good. It will just be like, oh, this just makes it 50 times better. And then there will be times where I'll describe something and Andrea won't do any of it. And instead, he'll just do whatever the fuck he wants. And like there's some of those double page spreads that he does, like where he just goes kind of into madness. And I'm like, this, you're a gene. There's no way to describe this. And you just like, so yes, thank you. I just say thank you. By the time that I was writing the third, because, you know, I wrote the first issue, he is then drawing that, and I'm learning how he works and what his strengths are. And then I just want to play to those strengths. So by the time that I'm writing the third one, I'm really trying to play to those strengths. So the script in the third one, there are a couple of double page spreads where I stopped trying to describe too much and instead would give him an idea of, you know, something in this vibe, and here's the information that we need to know in this double page spread. And I would describe what the information we needed to convey was, and that's it. And then say, go for it. Like, I can't wait to see what you do.
Do your magic.
Yeah.
All right. Am I wrong if I'm saying that you might be working on a sequel to a Batman Imposter, and that it might be even be announced or released whenever we've got also more developments on the Batman 2?
Are you wrong?
Am I?
maybe. It's not happening right now, but okay. It's truly not happening right now, but I talk to the DC Comics guys all the time. I'm very clear with them. I really want to come back and do a sequel to Batman the Imposter. Like, I really want to continue. I really want to continue with Andrea, with Jordi Belair. I just want to keep that family together. And like, I would just love to continue like our weird little side universe here. But got to keep at the movie. First.
For now, yeah. First. All right. Well, thank you a lot, Mattson. It was really a pleasure to chat with you. And it will be another pleasure to chat with you later with Lee about Vicious Circle.
Can't
because
wait.
We still have to speak about that beast of a book. So thank you very much. I'll see you later.
Thanks for having me.